The Football Pod with Paddy and Andy.
For me, footwork has been something that's got me out of trouble on more than one occasion on and off the pitch, so I'll go with that one.
Download the OTB Sports app and subscribe to the GAA podcast feed now.
Okay, so our next guest is a name you may have heard mentioned at the recent Olympics when Jasmine Camacho-Quinn won gold in the 100 metres hurdles, and John Coughlin was amongst those thanked. And John has been working as a sprint coach for, well, long time now. John, you're very welcome to the show. How are you doing?
Thanks, Joe. Delighted to be here. Yeah, I've been in the game, sprint coaching, strength and conditioning, speed coach for over 20 years now. Yeah,
right.
It's been a bit of a journey.
I'm sure it has. How do you fall into that then?
I suppose when I was in school, I played rugby and a number of other sports, but probably then moved towards athletics and became a bit of a geek in terms of the training behind speed, power, endurance, all the physical components, which led me to basically study sports science. Continued then kind of doing athletics in college and kind of progressed my interest in it. I did an internship at a professional sprints group. I was lucky enough to back in 2000 in the United States. It was a world-renowned sprints coach at the time, and still is a world-renowned sprints coach, Lauren Seagrave. I was very fortunate to, you know, be involved in a training group there that year produced a double Olympic champion in the women's 200 meters, Pauline Davis Thompson, and she was on the 4x100 team for the Bahamas at the Sydney Olympics. So things kind of took off from there. Spent a good bit of time in the US in the early 2000s, but it was kind of over and back between the US and Ireland, mixing between doing athletics and working with team sports. And I've kind of mishmashed the two for the last 20 years, I guess, you know what I mean, trying to apply the science of training, speed, power, endurance to try and enhance sports performance in whatever field that is, or event or sport that is. Yeah.
And is it a difficult field to make money in and to have consistent employment in?
Well, it probably depends on where you are in the world. It probably depends on where you're based in the world. You know, you're probably not going to open up too many job adverts in Ireland if you're a sports science graduate, I suppose, that's advertising for a speed coach for wherever. But it's kind of what you make of it. It's probably a bit more unconventional. Probably is a little bit harder, but I think where there's a will, there's a way. And you can, you know, you have to be a little bit entrepreneurial spirited in some ways to kind of make it work too. But you can, you know, the path has been, it has been interesting for sure. It's been a very interesting journey. So, you know, I'm happy to be here, you know.
You're still getting away with it 20 years later, I suppose.
Managing to pull the wool over people's eyes. So
does it tend to work with almost a freelance contract here for 6-7 months, or does a certain athlete reach out to you, or does a federation tend to reach out to you? I know you've done some work in the world of GAA as well, Ballyboden and Mead. I think from 2016, you were Mead's head of physical development. So that's how it tends to work. Mixture of everything in terms of individuals maybe reaching out, and then also federations reaching out perhaps.
Yeah, it's quite different between different ones. I'm actually, my involvement in GAA is actually goes back a little bit further than that. I first got involved in GAA in the early 2000s, believe it or not, went as back as far as my first sojourn into GAA training was actually back with the Mead Hurlers, believe it or not, back in 2002, 2003. But from there on, I got involved actually with a Craig Kieran club hurling team in Dublin that won a Dublin championship actually in 2006. And I was spent 7 years working with Dublin hurling teams, actually between the seniors, the minors, the under 21s, then moved on. Actually did some stuff with the Mead minors, overlapped a bit with the Mead minors, then with Ballyboden, then with the Mead seniors. So each situation, when you're working under the GA, you're kind of employed on more of a, like what I'd say is a short-term contract basis. When I was actually with the Mead, with the senior team from 2016 to 2019, that was a longer term, that was a 3-year deal. But it's, and if you're working internationally, the way it works is a federation may hire you. You might be on a contract for, you know, 3 years, 5 years or 2 years, or you might be just hired on a short-term basis for an individual athlete. It can be quite diverse in terms of the difference in situations that are, you know, brought before you.
How do you build your reputation, John? How does it work?
I think you try to do as good a job as possible. I'm a believer in you know, the thing that I attracts me to the doing what I do is I'm a believer in kind of like a meritocracy, and athletics is very much measured. It's easily measured. You know, it's times, distance, performance. It's much more measurable and objective. But even if you're working with a team sport, I would get from a personal point of view, I'd get a lot of satisfaction in terms of, you know, if you're working with a player, you're trying to improve their speed, or you're trying to improve their power levels, their strength levels, their endurance levels, and seeing that transfer thing. So it would be a lot of the stuff that I would do. I'd be big into measurement. I'd be a bit of a data geek, I suppose, you could say. But that would be the thing. And, you know, you know, I think as time goes by, people would recognize, you know, when you're getting results, that's kind of how it works a lot of the time. Yeah.
So how do you make someone faster?
Yeah, that's a how long do you have, Joe? It's a great question. You know, speed is a kind of like a complex, what we call a biomotor ability. So biomotor abilities in sports come from, you know, you got strength, power, endurance, speed, flexibility. And in some ways, strength is a bit more easily kind of explained, and endurance also. It's more simplistic. Speed, you know, when we're talking about just speed comes in various forms. If we're talking about just, I suppose, running speed, I would take a very analytical approach, first of all. I studied biomechanics. So biomechanics is basically the appliance of physics to the human body. And there is what we call a, you know, optimal way for each person to run based on their physiology, leg length, muscle mass, flexibility. And it's basically applying laws of physics. And very often that underpins the whole philosophy is for strength and power expression and speed expression is very much dependent on your limb positionings and timing of the limbs. So obviously you do a lot of work in the gym and with plyometrics and elastic strength training, reactive strength training, but that is obviously vitally important. But the thing that underpins speed training is actual, you know, in layman's terms, is actually technique. But what I've described is it's the positioning of the limbs, timings. In some ways, you could use the analogy, it's a bit like a golfer. You know, a lot goes into a golf swing in terms of, you know, trying to strike the ball the correct way and the mechanics of that. It's very similar to running, where sometimes if you just try and move as fast as you can, that's not actually the most efficient way. So we break down the technique, we look for areas of improvement and how, you know, and it's, I think it's something you get from doing it for a long time. You can quite easily just spot things quite obviously with athletes that come to you first or players come to you first, so some obvious big wins in terms of areas they can improve on. So what we're trying to do is you break it down and you're basically trying to reprogram the nervous system. You're basically trying to reprogram the computer because the brain sends a signal to the muscles. So you're trying through a lot of rehearsal, you can change the way the nervous system acts for everybody. You know, so there's good room for improvement.
Yeah. So you might teach a slightly different technique to me and somebody who had much longer or shorter limbs or was a different height to me.
Absolutely. And it would be very much dependent on your specific technical, say, strengths and weaknesses for want of a better word. So if I was, say, coaching two people, say I was coaching you and another person, you're doing a training session with me, I might tell you to block your ears when I'm telling somebody else something, because what they need to hear might be a completely wrong thing what you need to hear. So you're going into neuro-linguistics there in terms of understanding and turning moves into words into feelings and then those feelings into movements. So it's actually quite nuanced in terms of the vocabulary and the language that you use. At least sometimes you might think the coach is just that you're using that word there, but that word that sometimes a huge amount of thought has been put into something that might seem very just kind of nonchalant kind of in terms of what you use. It's the wording of it, you know, and trying to get the body to change.
Is everybody, say, lining up in an Olympic final running with pretty much flawless technique, or would you see issues even at that level?
Even at that level, believe it or not, they're obviously at the extreme end of the spectrum in terms of getting close to what we might say perfection. But even within that, I would see definitely. And it depends on the athlete, would see some areas that could be improved on. It's very, very nuanced, and it's obviously happening at an extremely high speed, because say in the men's 100 meter final, these guys are traveling at 12 meters per second. So trying to change things at that speed is quite difficult, but it can be done. It just takes a lot of training and practice of trying to do that and breaking down what you're trying to do.
Was Usain Bolt technically perfect?
Usain Bolt was close to it, but I would think there were still things he could have improved on. And he probably had a little bit what we describe as backside mechanics, where your heel comes up a little bit too high at the back, which basically means that you reduce the front side force application distance, which means he probably could have been getting more power out of the ground if he had a little bit less backswing in the leg. And he was probably pointing his toe away a little bit at the back, which is probably which was causing the lever arm of his leg to be longer, which means it's going to rotate a little bit slower. So if he actually kept his foot and ankle dorsiflexed at the back, it would actually shorten up the lever and it would allow him to rotate through the leg a little bit faster.
Who had the best technique you've seen?
Of all time, I think of anybody I've seen, Carl Lewis. He was close at full speed. So that's mid-race onwards. They're pretty much at close speed or very, very close to it. From mid-race onwards, he was close to perfection. So, and the technique of running is actually different when you're at the middle of the race and at the start. So we call it the start, say from 0 to 40 or 50 meters, we would call that the acceleration phase, depending on the level of the athlete. Like less powerful or slower athletes would have a shorter acceleration phase. But for example, elite level sprinters at the Olympic 100 meter final level, their acceleration phase would be longer and they get into their top speed later. But in terms of top end speed technique, Carl Lewis was as close that I've seen as you would get. And then you get into acceleration. When you talk about acceleration, somebody like Asafa Powell was exceptional in terms of acceleration. So if you could merge those two together, you know.
And John, to what extent do you think the likes of, say, Lewis, who you mentioned was great technique, or even Bolt, or any of them really, to what extent do you think I would have been able to recognize their running style when they were 12, 13, 14, as opposed to they chiseled it out and they worked on technique and they worked with people like you? I mean, I just wonder, you know, there are certain golf swings you see, to extend the analogy, and you can spot Rory McIlroy at 5, and that's Rory McIlroy. So quite often with the geniuses out there, it's just DNA and it's just a natural thing. And any improvement a sprint coach could make is minimal. So for instance, someone like Lewis, who is near perfection, do you think he was born with near perfection?
No, I don't think he was born with near perfection. I've actually seen videos of him when he was in high school. And for sure, you could see he was like an athlete with serious talent, just in terms of the physique. And it was almost like the way he ran and how fast he ran, based on how raw his technique was, you could see this guy was special. So you'd probably be saying to yourself, well, if this guy could really hone his technique, he could be unbelievable. So very often what sprint coaches, you know, I spent a good bit of time in the US, and it's a big thing for in college coaches now, when they're recruiting, they're looking for these type of things. They're looking for the next Carl Lewis or the next Usain Bolt. So the recruiting system is huge in terms of looking at high school, and they'll be looking at these kids from a young age and trying to sign them up, because it's really important to get the, you know, at the absolute elite level to get the raw talent. Now, having said that, everybody, no matter how talented you are, can improve. And the improvements can be actually more significant than some people think. Because I would have had this discussion with GA teams where managers might have been kind of make a joke. You can't make them faster. I said, you actually can. And then by the end, they go, actually, I thought you're right. But when it comes to the technique, someone like Lewis was raw. So I think what a lot of coaches are looking for now is these kind of athletes. And I think Bolt has probably been a major influence of that, is where they're looking for that kind of like raw talent that can run fast. Maybe being tall helps, for sure. Having said that, you can still run fast without being tall. The Chinese Su Bingtian ran 9.83 in the Olympic semifinal. He's only 5'9". But you would say, classically, people are looking for like a long, what we call femur length would be helpful. But but they're not. They're not. There's something special in somebody like Lewis there. But in terms of the technique, it was by no means perfect when he was younger. No, by no means.
Interesting. No.
Yeah.
I appreciate conditioning is key and strength training is key. That said, are most of us just born genetically? We either win the lottery or we don't. Are most of us born with a certain number of fast twitch muscles?
Well, there definitely is a genetic element to it, but there's also a thing called genetic expression. Okay, so we're all born with a certain type of, you know, muscle fiber types. You know, obviously when we're born, we have a set amount. Now, through training at different ages and different stages, even at a young age, you can actually, through the specific type of training, you can actually, if your genes are expressing maybe you're more slow twitch or you're more fast twitch, you can actually, through training, get them to shift one way or the other. So you can actually change more your genetic or fast twitch type based on the type of training you do, and vice versa. You can move it more towards slow twitch based on the type of training you do. Now, some people, of course, will have still a higher level when they're born than others, but it can be massively influenced. And people would very often see these, you know, phenomenal athletes at the Olympics and say, wow, they were, you know, they're just these natural talents. I mean, and a lot of them come from countries. If you look at some of the sports, say in the United States, for example, you know, they've produced a lot of the best sprinters in history, you know, across the board. But if you look at a lot of American sports, you know, you got basketball, American football, even baseball. A lot of those sports are involved. It's speed, explosiveness in them. So in some ways, even by doing those sports at a young age, they're kind of like informally training. American sports are very much based around speed and power. So that definitely helps, even though they're not, you might say, training formally for the event, but that for sure helps in terms of, you know, developing those muscle types, that genetic expression we're talking about. And even by talking about, you know, developing tendons and ligaments that give you more explosiveness and plyometric and power output just within the sport. So there's big room for improvement within activities you do from a young age.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I would think if you are asked to work with an athlete, a sprinter who's doing very well at collegiate level or moving towards professionalism or Olympics, you're seeing a lot right with their technique. At the other end of the spectrum, I would say when you're asked to work with a GAA team and say 30 lads, for instance, who've never worked with a sprint coach before, I would say some of the techniques you see are dreadful, painful to watch, horrific. So, it's an interesting thing because, so I grew up, soccer was my main sport, GAA was my main sport, played a lot of tennis and then did everything in between. Like when Wimbledon was on, we played tennis. When the Open was on, we played golf. When rollerblading was in, we were rollerblading. But I was naturally pretty fast, but I would say the extent of my speed training was in that first bit of every session before you get to actually play the match, which is all you want to do when you're growing up. Yeah. It would have been a sprint to that cone, then the next cone, do shuttle sprints. Shuttle sprints was kind of it. But at no stage did anyone say, let's think about your running technique. It was just do shuttle sprints and hopefully you're fast. So I would think there's a big old area there we could improve upon.
100%. I've spent a lot of time in the GA and not even just at like what you might say the elite level within GA, like where you're talking about intercounty. I've worked a lot with club teams, and you know, when you're down with the club, you see what's done with juveniles and other teams. You're looking around to see what's been done. So yeah, you're absolutely correct. And believe it or not, like shuttle sprints is almost like, I wouldn't even call true speed training, because it's almost what we describe in the field. We would call it speed endurance training, because true speed training is where it's done at the highest possible quality with basically full recovery in between. But if you're kind of doing shuttle sprints, you're going back and you're still out of breath and you go and do another one, you're not fully recovered. So you're not really training even the speed, never mind the technique. The technique aside, it's not even speed training. No, but
you're right. It's more of an endurance test, actually.
Yeah. So it's not even like, and I've seen this before, and I think it's a huge area in terms, especially for youth development. But to be honest with you, in all age groups, I think it's an untapped area. Not just in GA, but all sports, soccer. I've got a nephew involved. He's a 7-year-old. He's playing, you know, soccer, and you know, the kids are fast, but it's something, again, I think, you know, we look at the Irish soccer team, we look at the Irish rugby team, international sports. I believe they could be a lot faster based off of, and same with the GA, based on maybe a couple of tweakings of the train. And you're not, you know, ultimately they're doing their own sports. You know, they're not going down there. If they wanted to do sprinting, they'd join an athletics club. Yeah. But what I describe is, if you did the right kind of sprinkling of training, you could get like nice, what we call, you know, small regular doses of the correct type of training. It could make a big difference.
Because to be fair, and I only use the GA example because you mentioned you work with some GA clubs. Like, it applies to football, rugby, you name it, everything. I guess to be fair, if you picture Michael Johnson with his straight back and very upright stance now running, which we can all picture, this iconic image, that kind of technique, I don't feel works so much on a soccer field or a GA field or a rugby 100, field
where 100%,
you need to have pointy elbows. There's people coming in and encroaching on your space, and you need to be that bit more bent over and ready
absolutely.
To go. So
absolutely.
Would you teach different techniques to different sports?
Here's how I approach it, because this is something, and it's a great question, and it's something I've obviously thought about a lot, because I've worked a lot in team sports, and I go, well, you know, they're not just running in a straight line out of blocks here. Yeah. They've got opponents coming at them. They're getting the ball, or they're moving from different positions. They're not exactly...
You can be sprinting and you still have to be ready at any moment for a massive change of direction.
Exactly. So there's linear speed and then there's change of direction speed. So the way I approach it is initially I do, when I'm first going, I go, okay, guys or girls, I'll explain to them, we are now going to, I'm going to, for the first few training sessions here, train you as if you are a 100 meter runner. Now, I know this isn't what you're doing in your sport, but bear with me. If you learn the very basics and fundamentals, we can then start shifting that into more sport specific scenarios where you can then try to transfer and go, all right, I see what you're talking about here, but you got to get a grasp on the bare fundamentals first. And what we describe also, there's another way of describing this, is if you do raw speed training, even by itself, and I would argue this strongly, and I'm not saying it's the optimal way of doing it, I believe you need to do, it's a combined approach where you do raw speed training and you do the sport specific speed training. But I do believe even if you train somebody to be even just two tenths faster, which is very possible for an untrained athlete, 0.2 seconds faster over 20 meters, which is 2 meters over 20 meters, even in a straight line, if they get consistent with that speed, they will automatically transfer that into a game situation without even having practice. And then they will actually get better having done the game situation. You're basically, what you're doing is you're developing their full capacity, their maximal capacity, their output capacity, and then there's actually the game capacity in terms of where they can tap in. That. So you're tapping in, if your overall capacity is bigger, working at the same percentage in a game should be as you were before, should be faster if your overall capacity is increased.
Yeah, it's very interesting. And because, again, to go back to my own experience, which I think is probably very familiar to most Irish people listening. So on my various teams, GAA and football, again, doing the shuttle cone sprinting, I always wondered, so it's kind of good to ask you, that type of training, almost regardless of how far apart the cones were, because the coach would always insist that you touch the ground, I felt I was always all running, practically bent over in anticipation of trying to get down and touch the ground. And it did occur to me that when I watched the best sprinters, they were far more upright. So I often wondered, am I trying to bed in here completely the wrong technique by being bent over at the waist when I'm sprinting?
Yeah, I mean, and bent over the waist definitely doesn't help. But when you're in team sports, the primary type of running that happens in team sports, obviously you've got the change of direction, so you need to have a specific type of strength and coordination for that, and practice. It's a combination of things. But let's just park the change of direction for the moment. But if the primary, that's just got type of just pure type of running that occurs in team sports is actually acceleration running. So it's mainly like short bursts over, you know, 2 or 3 yards, maybe 5 meters, 10 meters, 20 meters. And in that situation, you actually want to have a bit of a leaned position with the body.
Yes.
You're not upright.
Yes, true.
Very rarely. The situations, it's much rarer. There are situations, and there is an advantage to also having an upright top end speed for, you know, where you have to make a longer sprint. Maybe, you know, you're a full back in a soccer and you have to make a sprint like 50 or 60 meters for sure, that's a challenge. But the majority of the sprints happening in team sports on pitches, like whether it's GAA, whether it's soccer, whether it's rugby, let's just taking those three tracks, the majority of the sprints happening there are acceleration sprints where you want to be in that leaned over position. Yes. So you're basically putting yourself in a position to apply actual force more horizontally. Mm. So your body position should almost be in a similar position to the line of force you want to apply. And when you're trying to accelerate, you want to be trying to get as much horizontal force into the ground in the right timing. And basically that's where the Newton's laws of physics come into play. For every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. So if you're applying a horizontal force in the correct way backwards, it's going to project you forward the way you want to go.
Yes.
Now, obviously you're not thinking about this. This happens so quickly. This happens in the training. This is the theory behind it. And then you move on to the automatic stage eventually, you know, but definitely in team sports, it's not the same as, you know, Usain Bolt at 70 meters in a 100 meter race.
Yes. We're talking here with John Coughlin. If you just tuned in, he's a sprint coach. He's been working in Ireland and around the world for the last 20 years, recently with Jasmine Camacho Quinn, who won gold for Puerto Rico at the Tokyo Games. One last one, and then maybe a couple more questions about your career, John, and where you see it going and everything. What are the 2-3 big mistakes that you see most field athletes making when it comes to their speed? There must be like 1, 2, 3 things that you must see at teams up and down the country, and they can be big wins, I suspect.
I think big wins. I think you can actually get big wins by without even doing speed training. The biggest thing I've seen is lack of flexibility and mobility. It's like, and this is free speed. And by and large, I've never seen basically a GA, for example, a GA player, and the same goes, to be honest with you, rugby or soccer. But the GA, to be honest with you, could be the worst culprit in some ways. And I love the GA. I've spent most time in terms of team sports, and they're great, great guys. But in terms of flexibility and mobility, it's absolutely vital. Like if you aren't flexible or mobile enough, you are literally running. It's like running with a straitjacket on your legs. Your legs just can't move freely.
So which muscles or areas in particular would you look for flexibility for speed?
The big areas are in and around the hip area, the glute muscles, the hip flexors, and the hamstrings. They're the main ones.
Yeah, I don't know what it's probably not an Irish phenomenon, but I do feel like everyone's hips are all very, very tight.
Yeah, we sit down a lot.
Yeah,
is a big problem. Yeah, and in Ireland, the weather also, we're indoors a lot, especially in the winter. And when you're indoors, you end up sitting down more.
Okay.
It's a fact. And also, colder weather makes you tighter. If you're in warm, that's one of the reasons why sprinters generally will come from hot countries or train in warm weather. It's just easier to get the body ready and loose to go when you're in warmer. The muscles are more relaxed or looser. So that's one thing. The other thing I would say is actually, as well as the mobility, is actually just taking the time out to do and understand what true speed training is. It's like you said, as you touched on there, it's not doing shuttle sprints. You know, it's just doing a little bit of quality, and you don't need to. And the thing is, especially with team sports players, you can incorporate it into the warm up, and just you don't need to. You might only need to do it 2 or 3 times a week. Even to be honest with you, if you're doing it consistently twice a week, a little bit, the improvements aren't seen as immediately like you would in the gym. Where if you go in and say, for example, you do a bench press, you know, week one you're able to do, you know, whatever, 50 kilos, week two, you're able to do 55. And that's in the gym, it's much easier to see your improvements because weights are actually measured. I mean, the numbers are down on them. So it's not as easy to see the improvements in speed. So you just have to be patient with it and be consistent with it.
Yes. And so I definitely take your point that flexibility is maybe the big easy win. In terms of actual running technique, be it you're watching an inter-county match or you're working with a local club team, I'm sure there's lots of things we're doing wrong, the way we plant our foot or too much time on our heel or whatever. Are there certain things that slower people have a tendency to do that they could think about changing in terms of technique?
Yeah, the biggest mistake I think technique-wise people are doing is they're landing too much out in front of their center of mass, which is basically causing a braking effect when you run. So your center of mass basically is where your hips are. So when you're running, you want to create more propulsive forces as opposed to braking forces. So you're going to create more propulsive forces by striking closer to as close as possible to dead underneath your hips as possible. And that'll actually minimize braking forces and, you know, help to maximize the propulsive forces.
Okay, so a feeling of that would be to feel like your legs are landing more underneath your hips.
Yeah, exactly. And the funny thing is when people try this the first time, they'll actually feel like, oh, I'm just going to fall flat on my face. Because I think a lot of people do that as a kind of like a, as a protective mechanism. But actually, you get you people that have done a lot of this will get used to that feeling, and it, you won't feel like you're falling. But the first time you're doing it, you'll almost feel like, oh, if I do this, I could fall over here.
Yeah, very interesting. Yeah, I would imagine so. Probably better for your muscles as well. Maybe less likely to tear something.
Yeah, definitely. And the hamstring, one of the main causes of hamstring injuries, from what I can see, is what I just spoke about, is landing too much in front of your center mass. The hamstring takes the load away more. Whereas if you strike with the right position underneath the hips more, it's going to take the load off the hamstrings more. Yeah.
So look, I mentioned, you know, you, like I said, you worked with a recent Olympic winner, and in 2015 you were out working in China. I think the federation hired you out there, and GAA down the years, I know Paul Heschen you worked with. What's the plan for the next couple of years? Are you going to be more in Ireland or working around the world, or is that even a choice you have?
For the short term, I don't do really long-term plans in a way. I kind of, you know, I take it, you know, a couple of years at a time kind of thing. I will be, most likely is I'm going to be in the US for the next couple of years. I do like traveling as well and working with different countries and different cultures and things like that. And of course, I love Ireland too. The likelihood is for the next couple of years, we'll be working with athletes in the US, and then maybe doing some stuff in terms of consulting with teams and team players too as well.
But, and do those individual athletes hire you, or is that some group?
Yeah, it's basically, like you said, generally the way it works, it is basically the and a coach will set up usually a group, and they'll put the word out, look, I'm coaching. Then the professional athletes will decide. There'll be a certain amount of coaches, and the professional athletes will decide who they want to train with. Sometimes shoe companies get involved and agents get involved too, in terms of, you know, who they might, you know, it's in their interest too, you know, the athlete runs well. So a coach becomes known, an agent will maybe advise an athlete to go and train with the coach, but the athlete basically hires the coach.
Yeah. Do you know, it's fascinating across the interview, listening to you talk about technique. Like, for instance, I didn't ask you about many athletes. So I just asked you about Bolt, and you make that observation about his technique. It strikes me TV punditry of athletics is very, very average. They talk a lot about how much an athlete wanted it and the psychology, and it's all very, I think, results oriented. You know, if one athlete wins, they find the narrative to suit that. I never hear discussions of technique on the TV. I don't know how well served we are by punditry, athletics punditry, that is.
Yeah, I think, you know something, Joe, I think that actually can kind of apply in a lot of sports too. Sure, I think, you know, if you look at Premier League, even like, you know, some of the coverage of some of the top channels, like, and you know, they're interviewing Jurgen Klopp or Pep Guardiola a lot of the time, or you're watching pre-match press conferences. A lot of the time, the focus is on the mindset and the psychology. Obviously, that's a massive part of it. But there's, you know, from what I've seen as an elite level sport, whatever sport is, there's a huge like technical and tactical aspect to it that's maybe not touched upon. You know,
yeah. Some, to be fair, I think it has massively improved. The likes of Neville and Carragher do it. Whereas, yeah. I don't know, Usain Bolt's about the most famous athlete of my lifetime. I've never heard his technique really analyzed on the BBC when the Olympics are on, for instance. It's just, all the rest. So I'm curious for your thoughts on one last point, because I guess you are working around the world. In athletics in particular, like, the sport has probably lost me a little bit because I just don't have much faith in it. And that's unfair on other sports, I'm sure, because
it's understandable the way it is, to be honest with you. Yeah.
Even when I was reading, I was like, all the people you've worked with, like you mentioned there, Pauline Davis Thompson, if I'm not mistaken, Marion Jones cheated her out of a medal.
She was basically retrospectively given the gold medal.
That's right.
So she lost a moment there, you know what I mean? As a result of a cheat.
Yeah. It's terrible. Yeah. And even when I see, God, you worked in China in 2015. I mean, all I think is, Sun Yang, the swimmer, given a 4-year ban recently. Think I just did a quick Google just to check. So they reckon the whistleblower came forward a while back and was a Guardian piece from 3 years ago. So they reckon 80s and 1990s alone, 10,000 athletes systematically doped. So some as young as 11. The extent to which that is still happening, I'm sure, is it's not quite systematic. But I kind of just think.
Yeah.
So what are you seeing? What is your sense of the landscape? Because I still wouldn't be ready to kind of do much more than watch a race, but not get too excited beyond that.
Well, I agree with you. And to be honest with you, I don't think enough effort has been made by the top governing bodies in the sport to catch the cheats, genuine cheats. I don't think there is still. That's my good. I think there could be more. I think the drug testing, it's just not good enough. Like, I mean, it's not, it's like there's, I don't know, the sport, I'm pro athletics, obviously I work in the sport, but I'm a fan of sport, but it's also, to be honest with you, it, in a lot of ways, my interest and passion has been definitely damaged by it, by some stuff that's gone on, and you become cynical. But I would get quite frustrated at times in terms of saying there's like obvious cheats there, and like, how are they getting away, like the drug testing can't be that good.
Yeah.
If there's people obviously out there trying.
How would you know, John, someone's a cheat? Just from what you, whispers in the sport or by watching their performance?
You hear things, you see who people, different people are associated with. You might have seen a pass. And you know, if there's an athlete that's tested positive twice before in their event and they're like allowed back in the sport, you're going like, where are we going? It's like, yeah. I mean, where, and you, and it's you have to question like, where are their ethics? Like, they obviously don't have any problem doing this, so you think that they're going to learn the third time around. But I think they need to go a bit deeper. I think if there was a real will from the top, I think you could go in. And the reason Marion Jones actually ended up coming clean is when the actual feds got involved in
Balco.
In Balco, right? She was basically going to perjure herself, and it was only then she was basically lying up to that point, and she's probably going to take the whatever ban. But it was only when she figured that she could end up in jail, that's when she started talking. I actually think there should be more criminal charges brought in for drug cheating. I think that would be one way, and people would think twice about it if you think I could spend time in jail for doing this, for you know, and charge people with fraud, because that's basically what it is.
Yeah.
You know, there it's you know, but I don't know how you do that. And I think there's a network also in terms of, you know, possibly dodgy, you might say, groups or camps that you go, hold on a second, there's been a whole bunch of athletes have tested positive here. How is that coach still allowed to coach? You know, what's going on here? Who's backing this? Like investigating, maybe even making, maybe, you know, even having like a kind of like a spy network or, you know, informant network where it's making it incentive for athletes to pass over information if they think there's something going on. You know, I think it could be done if there is a real will to do it.
Yeah, maybe that's the key question, I suppose.
What I think. I think the key, the will, and I just don't think the will is there. And unfortunately, what's going on now is they have a whereabouts testing system, which is almost going the opposite way, where they're now almost like trying to catch any athlete out, clean athletes included, out on technicalities to kind of show, oh, we've got a good doping system. We go, no, you're catching somebody out because they didn't fill a form correctly here or something,
right.
or they were traveling somewhere and they forgot to update something somewhere, and you know, they weren't where they were for that hour that they said, and now they're getting smeared, and you're going, they're going the wrong way about it, in my opinion.
Very interesting. Well, listen, continued success. I mean, it sounds like a really interesting journey you're on, and we might check in again sometime. I suspect there'll be a load of questions in about sprinting and speed work and all that kind of stuff. So we might get you on and fire a few at you some evening.
Sounds good. I look forward to it, Joe.
Okay, John. Thanks a million. John Coughlin. Cheers.